Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Yiannis Varoufakis about last weekend's European elections. And then, at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the political scientist Mohamed El-Masri about what's been going on in Egypt, which has been under military rule since last July. First, Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis is a frequent guest in this show. He's a professor of economics at the University of Athens who's been visiting at the University of Texas because the Greek economic crisis has made it nearly impossible for him to do his work in Athens. Last Sunday's European elections resulted in a strong showing for some hard-right xenophobes. The honorable exception was Greece, where the left party Syriza made a strong showing. Here's Yiannis Varoufakis to explain all. The European elections, the Financial Times had a helpful, putting that in quotes, box the other day that described it as a victory of the populist parties, and among those they include Syriza, the National Front, and UKIP in Britain. Or how would you characterize generally the European election results?
It was effectively, it transcribed in electoral terms, the wholesale loss of trust in the institutions of the European Union. The European Union for 4 or 5 years, you and I have been discussing this now all this time, has been handling in a wholly irrational way, with catastrophic human costs, the inevitable crisis of the Eurozone. And the European Union, as a result of this handling and the escalation of the crisis, which is not a great surprise, has been losing the hearts and minds of Europeans. All that happened last Sunday was that this loss of trust translated into a spectacularly misanthropic result. Centrist Europe, establishment Europe, has a tendency to try to dismiss this result as what happens when there's a crisis, there's high unemployment, and several Europeans are straying to the extremes, to the ultra-left and to the ultra-right, and that this is something that will eventually be ironed out. It will go away when growth picks up again and recovery is underway. None of this is true. This is a gross misrepresentation. What has happened is there was a shift to one extreme, to the ultra-right. The Syriza victory in Greece is a bulwark against that, but it is certainly not a shift towards the extreme left. The Syriza political platform is a Europeanist one. It's one of trying to salvage the crisis within European institutions and by fixing the Eurozone, not dismantling it. What we have is a wholesale misrepresentation of an electoral result that marks a misanthropic turn for Europe as a whole.
I want to return to Greece in more detail in a moment, but let's talk just about the right-wing victories. To what degree do you think these are symbolic protest votes, or are they actually a sign of a real shift towards a quasi-fascist right among a large segment of European opinion?
One hopes that this is not a secular trend in that direction. We know that the British, for instance, do not take their European Parliament elections very seriously. The turnout is very low. And already, opinion pollsters, if they are to be believed, are telling us that at least 50% of the people who voted for Nigel Farage, for the UKIP party, are not intending to vote in the same way in a parliamentary election. But nevertheless, there is, this trend is not to be dismissed, especially in places like Denmark and in France, not to mention Hungary, where the neo-Nazis, just like in Greece, have really taken a lead over civilized society. But look, this is what happens in the political sphere when the economics turn nasty and when the policymakers are reinforcing the economic crisis with very significant, very substantial human costs. The political scene fragments, disintegrates, and the only people that benefit especially in the absence of a serious left-wing political force, are the misanthropes, the xenophobes, and the racists.
Bracketing the British results, because Britain has long had a complicated and distant relationship with continental Europe, but France is, of course, at the core of the EU, next to Germany, the biggest, most important member. What do you make of the popularity of the National Front?
You have to remember that the majority of the French people have protested their own elites drift towards the Bundesbank, towards the ironclad monetary policies of the German Central Bank since the early 1990s. You have to remember that when the Maastricht Treaty was put together in 1993, the French nearly rejected it. Then again, when the so-called European Union Constitution was put to a referendum, it was handsomely rejected. The majority of the French do not share the French elites and the French bankers' penchant for a kind of unity with Berlin and Frankfurt, the purpose of which has always been to crush any resistance by organized labor in France to the interests of the elites. Now, the problem is that, of course, over the last 20, 30 years, the left has lobotomized itself in France. It has been co-opted by the elites. President Mitterrand was very successful in doing this. The collapse of the Communist Party didn't help very much. So a political vacuum was created, and Marine Le Pen is exploiting this vacuum very deftly. And the result is the kind of electoral result that we saw. But this is not just a flash in the pan. There is a process here that has lasted for well over two decades, and which can be thought of as a discursive civil war in France between the majority of working people and their own elites.
And now, what is in it for the elites, that alliance with Germany?
You have to recall, of course, that France has always been the cauldron of revolution, and that French labor in particular has been quite recalcitrant and unwilling to accept a kind of an Anglo-Saxon deal whereby the working class will constantly be losing wage share. And just look at the trades union movement in France, how powerful it is compared to Britain, and how unwilling it is to enter into a corporatist deal compared to the German trades unions. One way in which the French elites have tried to squeeze trades unionism in France was by aligning themselves with the Bundesbank and creating a kind of deflationary wage squeeze based environment in France, emulating the German one, hoping that that would see to it that, you know, the French organized labor is sort of sandwiched between a depressed level of demand and very harsh monetary policies designed by Frankfurt.
As you said, the left lobotomized itself. Mitterrand came into office in the early 1980s trying some sort of expansionary Keynesian program against the Anglo-American consensus and reversed himself a couple of years later. So by 82, 83, France was on board with the neoliberal agenda. There is simply no left alternative to either the crypto-fascists or the elite politics you describe, right? There's just nothing else on offer.
Well, the left-wing opposition in France at the moment under Mr. Mélenchon has tried to recover some of the lost ground. But going back to the period that you described, that you alluded to, the period between 1980 and 1985, that was a very crucial period for France. Remember that when Mitterrand came to power, he forged a popular front kind of government between his Socialist Party and the Communist Party. The Communist Party was co-opted. In 1983, Mitterrand and Jacques Delors, who was later a very instrumental and important president of the European Commission, did a turnaround, the one you mentioned. They decided something very, very simple, that their policies could not be affected within France, and the only way of introducing them, a kind of soft Keynesianism, was to do it in the context of the European Union. They launched a rather foolhardy campaign for co-opting the Bundesbank. And the Bundesbank slapped them back into their pen with alarming viciousness. And ever since, the combination of the socialists and what was left of the Communist Party have been struggling to maintain the pretense that France was capable of nudging the Bundesbank in a direction that is consistent with the corporatist model that of the French variety that President Mitterrand was interested in. That, of course, has failed spectacularly. And the result is the state of the left in France at the moment.
And it seems that the reactions of European elites, at least from this distance, look like very much reminiscent of Brecht's line about wanting to dissolve the people and elect another. Are they going to rethink this strategy, or are they going to dismiss the results? What are the elites going to do in the face of this electoral earthquake?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Let me remind you of the first comment by the new French Prime Minister on the day after the European Parliament elections were announced, in which his party was thrashed. He announced tax cuts that would, of course, disproportionately favor the rich. Go figure, as they say.
So, more of the same. If you read the business press, they're all enthused that Europe is now turning the corner, that what three of the peripheral countries have now exited their rescue programs and are re-entering the bond market. So, all clear. What's your reading of the current state of the Eurozone?
Well, this is an amazing propaganda coup, the purpose of which is Goebbels-like, to take the truth and stand it on its head. Berlin and Frankfurt were determined to declare victory of the Euro, over the Euro crisis. So they did. And they have tried and succeeded, I have to say, in stabilizing financial markets in two ways. Firstly, by unleashing the European Central Bank and allowing the European Central Bank to announce that it would print as much money as necessary in order to stabilize Italy and Spain. And the second way, of course, was by, through austerity, to create deflationary forces that made even 1 or 2% interest rates, nominal interest rates, seem quite attractive to investors in an environment of falling prices. Let me give you one example of this new bubble that is being created as a means of perpetuating this myth that the euro crisis is over. Look at the Greek debt situation. The Greek debt is greater than ever. We've reached 182%, I believe, yesterday over GDP. The Greek state is more insolvent than ever. And yet a few short weeks ago, the Greek state issued bonds that sold like hotcakes. Now, why did they sell like hotcakes? They did because the ECB and Berlin signaled to markets that these bonds would be backed by them. So even though they are bonds issued by the Greek state, and everybody knows the Greek state is bankrupt, Berlin and Frankfurt winked to investors to buy those bonds. And all that was done prior to the European Parliament elections in order to maintain this facade of having scored a major victory against the euro crisis. The reality of the economic reality is abysmal. If you look at the Eurozone, we have major countries like Holland, like Finland, like Italy that are in recession as we speak. We have the periphery in a state of permanent depression, which of course is going to be found out for what it is in due course, in the next months, year. But by that time, the elites and the establishment would have reasserted themselves in Brussels, as well as in various regional national governments.
I thought it violated all the canons of what is sacred in Euroland for the ECB, essentially to finance governments by guaranteeing bonds. How'd they get away with this?
Through the power of their will, as Nietzsche might have said. Let me give you one example, something I discovered fairly recently. You know, I'm using the word discovered because one had to do a lot of digging. Last year, in 2013, the Greek government borrowed 41 billion euros to give to its banks. And that created a lot of debate, of course, as it should do. But what was completely unknown and under the radar was the fact that the Greek government gave another 41 billion to the banks through allowing the banks to issue IOUs to themselves that the Greek taxpayer, without being asked, consulted, or told, guaranteed. And these worthless IOUs, with the guarantee of the insolvent Greek state, were given over to the ECB in exchange for 41 billion. The ECB accepted this shenanigan completely, utterly, against its own charter. When some of us tried to create a debate, to give rise to a debate on this matter, we were met with a wall of silence. There you have it, a combination of continuing and deepening insolvency of the public sector, a banking sector that is becoming increasingly politically powerful and economically unviable, and a democratic deficit, which is turning Europe's peoples against Europe.
I'm speaking with the Greek political economist Yanis Varoufakis.
I was in Lisbon at the end of the year, just after Christmas, and I was amazed driving around town that there are all these Deutsche Bank offices with unbroken windows. The absence of any kind of popular rage against all this, aside from what we saw in the recent election, but the absence of any kind of formal or informal expressions of rage against this order is really striking. What happened? Why is there not more protest against these endless ways of austerity?
I think the politics of guilt have played a significant role in the periphery, especially in Portugal, and to some extent also in Ireland. Less so in Greece, but it is succeeding here too. The narrative according to which the euro crisis was due to sinful overborrowing by relatively lazy southern Europeans, plus the Irish, has managed to create a guilt complex amongst many in the population. Combine this with the helplessness in the hands of local elites, which are imposing irrational austerity policies with aplomb and with enthusiasm. And what you end up with is something that, at least in my mind, resembles to some extent what happened in Europe during the Black Death era, when the vast majority of Europeans blamed their own sinful living for the fact that they were dying like flies, and they were quite prepared to practice self-flagellation and to imagine that it was just, you know, their trials and tribulations and the deaths in their families, all this suffering was the proper redemption that they had to suffer through in order to cleanse themselves.
Now let's turn to Greece, which is to some degree an exception. But first of all, what's the state of the Greek economy? You've been away for a while, and you're back now. What's it look like?
I was surprised that it was worse than when I left it. And I left last September, August, September of 2013. There is a wonderful, wonderful inverted commas, decoupling between the situation on the ground and the narrative about the Greek economy that you read in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. Greece is being portrayed as a surprising success story. And this is based on the fact that the yields on Greek bonds has collapsed from 30% to 5%. Shares of in our banks, in our bankrupt banks, have risen substantially. There is interest by international investors, including John Paulson and other various vultures in paper assets here in Greece. When you come to Greece, if you are not particularly clued as to exactly what has been going on, you may be surprised to find that the number of boarded up shops, if anything, has risen. You talk to taxi drivers, restaurateurs, students, and the only thing that they will tell you is tales of gloom and of their plans to migrate. So this decoupling between the reality and the propaganda, I think, tells the whole story about Greece and about Europe as a whole.
Now, when Greek interest rates fell from around 30% to around 5%, somebody must have made a lot of money. Who was that?
Hedge funds. It's very simple. Hedge funds. That's why Mr. Paulson invested himself in here. And the reason why they dropped, of course, is because Germany and the European Central Bank signaled to the hedge funds, to the markets, that they intend to create a bubble. And so, you know, if you were given prior notice that some bubble was going to be built up, you would rush into it and the bubble would be inflated faster and you would make a mint as long as you get out before it bursts. It hasn't burst yet. There's no doubt that it will, because it's not as if, you know, the Greek state has become more solvent than it was. Remember when we first started talking about the Greek debt crisis and the fact that the Greek state was insolvent, that was back in 2010, let us remind our audience, the Greek debt was something like 120, 130 of GDP. Well, since then it's 182, and GDP is a fraction of what it used to be. And yet, interest rates, yields on Greek debt, has gone down from the 30% that we had back then, in late 2010, to 5% now. Now, how do you explain that? It's very, very simple. The bulk, 90% of Greek debt, has been shifted on to the shoulders of European taxpayers. They're going to have to take the haircut, which is inevitable because of the bankruptcy of the Greek state. And the hedge funds are holding only, you know, something between 5 and 8%. The rest belongs to several bankrupt pension funds. But that debt has been guaranteed to them not to be haircut. So, of course, its price goes up and up and up, and they make a mint.
And now about the political scene. Syriza did well in the election. What are their prospects for the future, and what exactly do they stand for?
Well, what they stand for is stabilization to begin with, just to end this never-ending six-year-old downward spiral where the bankrupt, corrupt bankers with a bankrupt, corrupt state are continuing to be in denial of the situation, perpetuating their own interests at the expense of society. So Syriza is about ending that spiral. And they know that the only way to do this is by bargaining in the toughest of manners with the powers that be in Europe. This is what they're standing for. They're not standing for exiting the European Union or even the Eurozone. They would much rather we weren't in the Eurozone, but they realized that an exit from the Eurozone would make things even worse than they are now.
That was your position, wasn't it? Is it still?
Indeed. My position and that of Syriza are very, very similar these days. So the fact that a party of the radical left has stopped an election and now is the leading party, the most powerful political force in the country, is highly significant. Of course, it's not enough, because these were the European Parliament elections, and the task ahead is to use this as a stepping stone towards overthrowing this government, so as to be able to go to Brussels and to Berlin and to Frankfurt, and to negotiate a humane deal, not just for Greece, but for Europe. Of course, this path is already paved with booby traps and landmines, both by the regime here in Greece, but also, and more importantly perhaps, by the European Central Bank and by Brussels. I can see a number of traps that are being set as we speak. In case Alexis Tsipras and Syriza succeed in the next general election, which will have to be called sometime in the next year, in winning government, winning office, the plan, as I see it, is to have created circumstances such that on the next day of his victory, he will receive a phone call from Frankfurt or even from the Bank of Greece representing Frankfurt, where he's going to be told that all the banks in Greece will be brought down within 24 hours unless he capitulates to every demand made of him, and in a sense, unless he capitulates to the existing policies and to the existing memorandum of understanding with the Troika.
And would that work?
The only way it will not work is if Syriza does its homework prior to that moment, and if a strategic plan is in place for ensuring that the cost to Frankfurt and to Berlin of carrying out such a blackmail tactic is greater to them than it is to us.
And it would make Syriza's job easier if it had some allies abroad, wouldn't it?
It would, but I do not believe that Syriza can count on allies in the first few crucial weeks. If you look at Spain, what you have is a turncoat, quisling government. Same in Portugal. The Irish have convinced themselves that they have exited their bankruptcy memorandum, but of course this is not true. It is continuing under a different name and in a different form. The only way that an alliance of progressively minded and rational leaders in the European Union can be formed is if Syriza not only wins government, but manages to survive for 2 or 3 months sufficiently in order to give itself an opportunity at the level of the European Union, at the summit meetings of European leaders, to use its veto power in order effectively to force the rest of the European leaders to start the conversation that we have not had over the last 5-6 years in Europe about the nature and form of the crisis, and actually have, for God's sakes, finally that debate.
And of course, the European bourgeoisie understands all this and will make life as difficult as possible for Syriza, lest the threat of a good example spread.
I have no doubt about this. I can already see the signs. I can even, through X-ray vision, discern the various booby traps and landmines that they are burying in front of us.
That was Yiannis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens, who's got a visiting gig at University of Texas. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the finale of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. The section is a Turkish march, a genre popular in Europe at the time. It's an eruption of almost comic militarism in the midst of the famed Ode to Joy, the unofficial anthem of the EU. Slavoj Žižek has an excellent analysis of this strange interlude in what is mostly a hymn to human solidarity in the film The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. It is, as Slavoj says, an ideology critique in musical form. The last line of the excerpt has a hero marching off to war, oddly enough. Next up is Mohammed Al-Masri. He is a visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Denver. A few years ago, we're all in love with the Arab Spring, and no part of that moment was more compelling than the masses gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo. Not long after the uprising deposed Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood won an election, only to be overthrown in a coup last July by the Egyptian military. Here's Mohammed Al-Masri to analyze things for us.
A couple of years ago, the world was thrilled by what was going on in Tahrir Square. Things have not turned out quite as planned, have they?
No, they haven't. I think that for a while, Egypt was on a democratic path. It was not a perfect path, but there was a basic democratic framework. Last summer, the Egyptian military carried out a coup against the elected president. And as is the case with pretty much all military coups, this has led to more authoritarianism and repression, certainly not more democracy.
Now, of course, there were some complaints among liberal circles that the elected government dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood was fundamentally undemocratic in some sense, and that it was repressing secularism, and that it was on its way to some sort of theocratic regime. What do you make of that critique?
Yeah, well, I think that the elected government can be fairly criticized for a number of things, frankly, and I've criticized them for quite a few of their policies that they implemented, and also policies that they should have implemented but did not. However, this idea that they were a dictatorship or a dictatorship in the making, or that they were out to establish a theocracy, these criticisms are frankly absurd, and they have no grounding in any kind of a political reality. The reality is that the Muslim Brotherhood participated actively in writing Egypt's constitution, the 2012 constitution, and in that constitution, you had term limits for the elected officials, regular elections. You had every Egyptian with the right to form and join political parties. You had every Egyptian with the right to own a newspaper without government permission. These all sound like very basic things to an American audience, but these are monumental in the Arab region and in Egypt specifically. So it would have been impossible to create a dictatorship, much less an Islamist dictatorship, in Egypt. The liberal and secular opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood could have simply waited. Instead of going to the military to carry out a coup, they could have waited 3 months until the parliamentary elections. And importantly, in that 2012 system, the parliament was quite powerful. Through the parliament, if they would have taken a majority, they would have had the final say on the prime minister. The prime minister was actually about as powerful as the president in that 2012 system. And according to some constitutional law scholars, he was more powerful than the president. So they could have had the final say on the prime minister, kind of ran the show through the parliament, revised the constitution to their liking. They could have even impeached Morsi through article number 152 of that 2012 constitution, the impeachment mechanism. So they chose that, you know, to avoid elections, and that they instead would prefer that the military intervene on their behalf. And I think it was a terribly misguided calculation.
I've heard people make similar complaints in Pakistan, for example, that democracy in Pakistan is frightening because it would lead to unfortunate results. Therefore, we need a military dictatorship to assure the values of liberalism or something. It seems kind of perverse, ideologically speaking.
Well, I would agree. I don't think it's ever a very good idea to call on the military to remove an elected president. The literature from political science suggests that when that happens, it pretty much always leads to a type of authoritarian order. It certainly does not lead to democracy. And I think that was going to be the case in Egypt, especially given the prominent role played by the Egyptian military for really 60 years since the 1952 revolution.
Let's talk some more about the army. It has been the dominant institution in Egyptian society for quite some time. You said, like, for essentially 60 years, correct?
Correct. And it has a very powerful, it has a powerful role politically and also economically. The military owns bottled water factories, macaroni factories. They own gas stations, resorts, real estate companies. They own or control, I should say, between 30% and 40% of the Egyptian economy. And they were really the biggest losers after the January 25th uprising. They stood to lose the most because over time, maybe not overnight, but over time, their power and control would have been diminished by democratically elected institutions. There were already, even just in the first year of the Morsi presidency, already grumblings that Morsi and the government planned to privatize some of the military's industries. So this is something that rubbed the military the wrong way. You also had, you know, if you have a democratically elected president and a democratically elected parliament, that means there's going to be more accountability. There's not going to be as much corruption. Just a practical example of something that happened after Morsi was elected is that he formed a fact-finding committee to find out who killed protesters in 2011 and 2012. That file was still active and sort of on the desk of the prosecutor general at the time of the military coup. But the evidence that's been leaked over the past several months suggests that there would have probably been trials. There would have been prosecutions of both police, high-ranking police officers, but also military officers. So the military stood to lose both politically and economically from a democratic turn in Egypt. And I think the Brotherhood arguably compromised too much with the military. That's actually one of the things that angered some of the liberal and secular revolutionaries in 2011 and 2012. The Brotherhood perspective, whether right or wrong, was that control needed to be taken away more gradually. That may have been a mistake, and it looks now like a more revolutionary approach in dealing with the military would have been preferred.
Now, let's talk some about the military's economic role. When you own a third of the economy, first of all, I'm guessing they weren't doing a real bang-up job of it. The Egyptian economy was not known for either its delivering prosperity or dynamism of any sort, was it?
No, the Egyptian economy was pretty much in shambles. Lot of corruption. So you had a very wealthy elite class, a very small class of military officers and government officials and wealthy businessmen sympathetic to that military order that Mubarak was running. So you had vast wealth disparities, right? On the one hand, you have people driving Mercedes Benzes and making millions of dollars. And then on the other hand, you have people living in the graveyards, quite literally, acute poverty. So Egypt is a poor country. It has been a poor country. Clearly, the military over the past few decades has not been doing a very good job. The Mubarak regime didn't do a very good job managing the economy, rampant corruption. And it's not really particularly shocking, just given the nature of autocratic rule. And this is why political scientists have been talking for years in the context of the Mubarak regime about an inefficiency crisis. There was literally a crisis of inefficiency in Egyptian society during that Mubarak period. I think that's one of the reasons why people were so hopeful that a democratic government, regardless of who was running the show initially, who was winning elections initially, that a democratic government could slowly bring about some positive changes, because a democratic government would have to interact with these checks and balances, some of which I already mentioned, right? The fact that there were term limits, the fact that there were going to be regular elections, the fact that you had a mixed presidential parliamentary system. So you had a president and a prime minister, right? The fact that you had multiple parties, a multi-party system. There were actually 40 political parties at the time of the military coup, kind of vying for political position, which is arguably too many parties. I think that over time we would have seen that number reduced. I think parties would have kind of combined, formed alliances. But now all of that has really been lost. There is no democratic framework to speak of. There is no democratic transition to speak of. Egypt is operating in an authoritarian order. The military general who carried out last summer's coup is set to become the president in what analysts consider to be a sham election after the main political competition has been completely eliminated and banned from political life.
I'm speaking with Mohamed El-Masri, a visiting scholar at the University of Denver. And what has the role of the United States been over the last several years, with the fall of Mubarak, the brief reign of an elected Muslim Brotherhood government, and then the coup? Where has the United States stood during all this?
Well, the U.S. has taken the position that they've always taken, that they're going to play ball with who's ever in charge in Egypt. So they were perfectly willing to play ball with Mubarak. He was an ally of the United States. In spite of the human rights violations and the dictatorial nature of his rule, the U.S. saw a relationship with Mubarak and with the Egyptian military as fundamentally important to their strategic interests in the Middle East, and in particular for the sake of peace with Israel and security for Israel. Once the tides had turned, the revolutionary moment occurred, and Mubarak was forced to step down, the U.S. kind of switched sides and said, well, they were very happy about the revolution and about the prospects for democracy in Egypt. When elections took place and when the Brotherhood took office, the U.S. was also willing to play ball with the Morsi administration. And I think they did that. I don't think that the U.S. was there's certainly no evidence that they were actively seeking a military coup. This appears to be something that was homegrown inside of Egypt. But once it happened, I think the U.S. had an opportunity to make a clear statement that would have been more consistent with its principles of democracy and freedom and human rights. And that statement would have been to say, this is a military coup, and we cannot provide funding, we cannot provide aid to a country that is governed by a coup regime. That would have been consistent not only with U.S. principles, but also with U.S. law. What we've seen, though, is the opposite. The U.S. has danced around the issue of military coup. They've refused to call the coup a coup, and have remained very ambiguous and have continued to send funds to the Egyptian military. And all indications are that relationship will continue. I happen to think that that's a strategic error. The U.S. desires stability, first and foremost, from the Middle East and from Egypt in particular. And military coups, particularly in this day and age, are inherently unstable. The last 11 months in Egypt are evidence of that. This is the most unstable period in Egypt's modern history. There are more than 40,000 political prisoners, according to the most recent data. Upwards of 3,000 people have been killed. Parties have been banned. And so it's really a recipe, frankly, for instability. And there's no indication that that Egypt is going to stabilize anytime soon. So I think that U.S. policy toward Egypt over the past 11 months has been misguided.
How much leverage does the U.S. have over the military? The U.S. does give substantial aid. Is it enough to really change the military's mind if the U.S. really leans on it?
I think so. I think that it's certainly worth a try, at the very least. But the U.S. provides the Egyptian military with $1.5 billion in military aid annually, and they also provide the Egyptian military with training, spare parts, and maintenance. So those are things that really the U.S., as political scientists like Professor Dalia Fahmy and others have pointed out, these are things that only the U.S. can provide the Egyptian military. These, you know, they're not going to get the same kind of benefits from a relationship with Russia, for instance. So I think the U.S. has leverage, and they have not tried to apply that at all, really.
What about these mass death sentences? I mean, it's been appalling to read of hundreds and hundreds of people sentenced to death in mass trials. Who are these people, and what is going on? It seems appalling.
Well, in Egypt, there's a deep state, as political scientists like to say. The deep state has various actors and participants. You have the military regime, you've got the police forces, the media, and you also have the judiciary. The judiciary, many of the high-ranking judges were appointed directly by former President Mubarak, and they're not necessarily interested in any kind of a democratic turn. In fact, the judiciary in Egypt was responsible for blocking and obstructing the democratic process in the aftermath of the 2011 uprising, which is actually one of the reasons why Morsi was engaged in this clash with the judiciary. But with respect to the mass death sentences, they are shocking. They're appalling. They're not necessarily entirely inconsistent with the behavior of the Egyptian judiciary. But I think this scale was, shocked a lot of people. We had 1,100 people sentenced to death in trials that lasted an hour or two, and the defense was not allowed to present evidence. And these two trials and 1,100 death sentences were dished out for the deaths of two for the alleged killings of two Egyptian police officers. So,
did they pronounce 1,100 people guilty of murder, basically?
Yes, that's what the 1,100 people were charged with murder, essentially, and sentenced to death. Some of those sentences have been commuted, but many of them still stand. And it's the same judge in both cases. And what I've argued is that this is actually consistent with Egypt's post-military coup campaign of elimination. There's been an ongoing campaign to essentially eliminate the Muslim Brotherhood from political and public life. There's quite a lot of evidence, very disturbing evidence for this campaign of elimination. And the attitude has been, you know, in the U.S. we say, if you can't beat them, join them. In Egypt, the attitude has been, if you can't beat them in an election, then just eliminate them. The Brotherhood won 5 consecutive free and fair elections, and most of them were not close. And I think that there was some desperation setting in that maybe it was going to be difficult to compete with the Brotherhood in the short term. And there was also certainly a lot of public anger. As I said, some of the policies of that the Brotherhood implemented angered a lot of people. And so the plan was then to carry out this military coup and then proceed to attempt to eliminate the Brotherhood by describing them as un-Egyptian, disloyal, treasonous terrorists, declaring them a terrorist organization, banning them, and then even banning their individual members from running for office, from running for parliament, for instance. Even in the Mubarak period, individual Brotherhood members could have ran for office as independents. But now that they've been prohibited from that as well. And political Islam as a political ideology has been banned in the new constitution, the 2014 constitution. So you're basically eliminating roughly half of society that seem to be sympathetic with that particular political ideology. It's not just the death sentences, but a lot of evidence that the Egyptian regime, the deep state, is attempting to eliminate that particular perspective, and in particular the Brotherhood and their supporters.
And this is the environment in which an election is upcoming?
Correct. Yeah, we have. This is the environment, and this is why many analysts would say that this election is a farce, that it is a sham. It's not possible to have a free and fair democratic election after the competition has been eliminated. It's also not possible to have a free and fair election in an environment, a media environment, which is almost completely one-sided and propagandist. You know, just over the last couple of days, we've had the media essentially scolding the Egyptian people for not voting. The people that have boycotted or chosen not to show up have been called traitors. They've been told that they're not loyal to the country, that they're not true Egyptians, that they're playing into the hands of terrorists. So this is the environment. It's a singular narrative. The anti-military coup perspective is not represented at all in Egyptian media. As I said, all of the networks that would have been oppositional were shut down last July 3rd, and they've remained closed. There are many journalists in jail, 41,000 political prisoners, as I already mentioned. 3,000 people have been killed, and instead of investigating the deaths, the killings, the mass killings, the police who have carried out these mass killings have been honored and praised as heroes, and statues have been erected at the sites of massacres.
And then finally, what happened to that spirit of Tahrir Square from a couple of years ago? Has that all dissipated?
That's premature. There have been protests ongoing, anti-military coup protests ongoing for the past 11 months, literally every single day. All across Egypt, there are marches every day. These are really a thorn in the side of the military regime. Al-Sisi has spoken of the military general who's about to be named president. He's spoken about these protests, saying that they're a major disruption, that it's impossible to get tourists to come back to Egypt. So I think there still is a revolutionary spirit. Unfortunately, I think many of the people protesting are Islamists who are sympathetic to the Brotherhood, not necessarily members of the Brotherhood, but people who are relatively sympathetic. Not all, but most of the protesters. What we have not seen is a return to the streets by the liberal and secular revolutionaries, the people that helped organize and instigate that 2011 uprising against Mubarak. It may just be a matter of time before they are so fed up with the status quo that they also hit the streets in large numbers. We may end up getting some kind of a reconciliation between the Brotherhood, or the what they call the anti-coup alliance, which is the Muslim Brotherhood and a number of other political parties who are opposed to the coup, mostly Islamists, and these liberal secular revolutionaries. We may end up getting some kind of a reconciliation. They may join forces again at some point in the future. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen right now or in the immediate future. There's still a lot of animosity from both sides. The liberal secular side is very angry with the Brotherhood. They think the Brotherhood lost the revolution, and the Brotherhood is angry that these forces, these liberal forces, supported a military coup. But I think over time, I think if you look at the next 2 or 3 years, I think that remains a possibility. And if that happens, I think it would be very dangerous for the current regime, because the Egyptian people have kind of proven that if they join forces and hit the streets, they're able to make serious change. We saw it in 2011. Obviously, it happened again in a very different way last year in the days that preceded the military coup on July 3rd. So I think it's Egypt is unpredictable. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I think that's something to watch for.
That was Mohammed El-Masri, a visiting scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Denver. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more of Beethoven's Ninth, picking up with the hero marching off to war in the midst of that ode to human solidarity. Carrion in Berlin again. Till next week, bye.